Okay, I think we're ready to get going. Welcome to the Angel Pool conference call. This is Michael Price of Angel Pool. I serve as the 2011 volunteer chair of Angel Pool, and I will be moderating today's call. We have an excellent panel today, which we will be discussing spilled milk, avoiding angel losses, and those most common ways tech companies are lost. First, some housekeeping announcements. But everyone is currently in mute. A number of questions were submitted in advance that we will work our way through. But if you have any burning questions during the first part, please press star 6 to unmute your mic and go ahead and ask your question. Please just barge in and don't be shy, as it's typically a pretty loud group. Then after you ask your questions, if you would kindly please press star 6 again after asking so that the background noise does not get out of hand to mute your mic. After the panelists' remarks, I will then remind everyone how to unmute their phones to ask questions. Just remember to press star 6 again right after you ask your question to reduce the background noise. For those joining the call for the first time, angelpool.org is an organization of volunteer leaders who help angel groups across North America and is dedicated to helping their leadership build strong angel groups in their cities to drive jobs, innovations, and exciting new companies. For those angel groups that need additional capital to complete a seed round or that would like access to more deal flow, the Angel Pool Syndication Network is now the world's largest, providing easy monthly access to a large number of other angel groups and deals within their region. This also provides the members of each angel group total visibility into all the best deals in their region. AngelPool.org also organizes knowledge and educational events like this one to share best practices and lift each other's angel skills and knowledge. This ensures that each angel group and their angels better fulfill their missions of helping entrepreneurs be more successful, so that our portfolios, in turn, will also be more successful. With that, let's go ahead and begin. Today's topic, again, is spilled milk, avoiding angel losses, and the most common ways tech companies are lost. The panelists are in alphabetical order, and also for the panelists who joined us, just a reminder to hit star 6 so that we'll be able to hear you when you speak. But again, the panelists in alphabetical order are Ann DeGeese with HealthTech Capital in Los Altos Hills, California. Beth Ann Kassman with Go Beyond Network in beautiful scenic Naples, Florida. Bill Pod with Landmark Angels in Greenwich, Connecticut. Joshua Watkins, Birmingham Angel Network in Birmingham, Alabama. Sue Preston with CalCEF Clean Energy Angel Fund in San Francisco, California. And Terry Moore with the VC Roundtable and Moore Venture Partners in Silicon Valley, California. I'll ask that each panelist briefly introduce themselves to the group for a quick minute, and then we'll go ahead and begin the panel discussion. So with that, Ann, if hopefully you've pressed star 6 so we can hear you, and Ann, if you would just give them just a quick introduction.
Yeah, my name is Ann DeGeese, and I'm part of Life Science Angels, and I started a new group called Health Tech Capital last year, and we're focusing on investing in companies that have very low FDA regulation and that focus on decreasing healthcare costs by using technology like computer and mobility.
Good. Ann, welcome to the call. Beth Ann?
Hi, I'm Beth Ann Kassman. I run this group in Naples. It's about 2 years old here in Naples, but we have 7 groups in Europe. And we've invested in a range of companies, including high-tech companies, and we've had 2 that have gone out of business, and we have 14 that are still in business.
Good. Well, our fingers are definitely crossed for you. Bill Pod with Landmark Angels. Bill DeCadere, you might need to hit star 6 so that we can hear you, and we'll circle back shortly. By the way, Bill, if by chance you're using Skype, for whatever reason, Skype doesn't put off a true signal when you press the keys, so it might not be recognized. If that's the case and you can't unmute your mic, maybe just call in from a different phone. Joshua Watkins?
Yes, I'm with the Birmingham Angel Network, and we're about a 4-year-old network now, and have certainly made our shares of mistakes, and I think are qualified to talk about common losses. Also have had some successes as well, so glad to be a part.
Good. Glad to have you here. We all have lots of rug burns, so welcome. Sue Preston?
Yes, with CalCEF Clean Energy Angel Fund. I'm the general partner for it. We are actually structured like a venture capital fund. We are a limited partnership. So we do have limited partners, both institutional and individuals, but we maintain a high level of transparency to our limited partners by having them participate, a select number of them participate on our investment committee, as well as having a lot of open access to our limited partners, both through our investment committee, which is an open forum for all our limited partners, and our deal flow on our website, and so forth. So we try to bridge the gap between angel structure and traditional venture fund, and we invest only at the seed stage as our initial investment, and then we reserve enough capital to maintain our pro rata throughout the growth of the company. We've made 4 investments so far in clean energy. We're relatively new, and we hope to make 4 to 5 more out of this fund.
Good. And Terry Moore?
Yes, Michael, thank you, and thank you all for allowing me to participate in this call today. The VC Roundtable is now in its 10th year. I've put on over 100 programs. We invite the leadership of angel organizations to meet with the institutional VCs and corporate investors, networks that I have a large number of relationships in. And we do 3 things. We have some education, we do deal flow discussions, and we talk about our funds for syndication and partnering purposes. And More Venture Partners, my latest venture capital fund, invests in early growth and expansion rounds of our top tech and life sciences companies. And what makes us unique is I leverage my strong relationships with the top-tier venture capital funds in Silicon Valley and back east to bring their lead investments to our syndicates. And we're excited about having a new fund. We've done our first deal, a diagnostics company called Astute Medical. We're about to close our second investment out of the latest fund.
All right, Terry, welcome to the call. And then, Bill Pod, were you able to... Okay, perfect. We can hear you. Go right ahead.
Okay. All right. Landmark Angels is a group that was founded in 2008, but we have 175 members east and west coast, and now we're going down the center of the country in Chicago, and then we'll be in Austin, Dallas in the fall. We do venture forms, about 15 a year. We have national sponsors, including Credit Suisse, and we've put in about $30 million over the last 10 years because we had a small group of 20, 25 investors, and we've had some successes and some not, and like any other angel group. And I guess what we're trying to do is to get our hold time lower in the 3 to 4 year range, and one of the ways we're doing that is looking at relationships the management team and board have with the likely acquirers of the business on day one, so that we therefore increase the probability and the hold time for the probability of success and the hold time of the investment, make it shorter.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And Bill, welcome to the call. All right, for the audience, we're going to try to attack this in different sections. What we thought we would do is first talk about losses triggered by key events. And then we thought we would then flip over to the operational side of the business and discuss losses triggered by different operational functions. And we're going to slice that up into several different areas to include planning, product development, marketing and sales, losses from management, losses from legal, and just plain old losses from bad luck that we can grunt about, but not do a whole lot about. All right, so let's begin then with the panelists on key events that trigger losses. As we were planning this session, a couple of questions and suggested topics came up just a few minutes ago, and I'm going to go ahead and put them up near the very top as a good starting point. And one of them was, and Bill, you mentioned this, and this is very true. As we're all aware, we've got a shrinking VC base. I think in Q4 there were only 15 funds on the venture side that successfully got done. We've got far fewer venture capital firms out there, and many of them are reserving capital to triage and nurse their existing portfolios, so even less origination. And so then the challenge for all of us as angels is that if the VCs are unlikely to be there to do that that solid A round or that B round, are we equipped to fill in and do that? And Bill, let me turn that over to you for your comments, and then we'll kind of circle around to the other panelists.
Okay. One of the things we've obviously at the key point that we looked at, because we've had deals in which there's been no capital going forward, and I think, Michael, even some of your regional calls you've seen out, like the BCs do, they'll talk to one another and see if they can get a syndicate member to put in more capital. And the angel groups, obviously, we do the same thing on some of these regional calls to see a company and that's been funded by a group or a fund in an angel side, and then where's that, you know, they're sort of stuck there if they don't get additional capital, especially in tight markets like we've had 2008-2009. The question is, where does that capital then come from? You either have to have new sources or VCs that have money, but the problem is you can't wait to that B round occurs to find out where that capital is going to come from. So you would need, I think, at least a pre-commitment if you're going to do those type of deals, and or other sources of capital. And some of the things we're looking at are family offices, ultra-high net worth investors who you usually find the fund of funds, but they don't have direct access to deals. No one really knows about them out there. They're hard to find, they're hard to get, but that's maybe a source for the future. So we've been relying primarily upon, when we do these deals, going to our own members and seeing there's some deeper pockets there, and or we know some angel funds that'll put in some capital either with us or would commit to the next round if certain milestones were met. And then we put our investor lead, our own angel investor lead, or someone that we know has experience to make sure those milestones are met, so they're going to get to that, they'll get to that next round through the angel fund or other capital that we've got there once those milestones are met. So, it's all changing today. The other way we're doing this is working with syndicate members. Second option is working with additional angel groups. We've got I call it an affiliate network. Those we work closely with, prioritize deal flow, share due diligence, with the idea that if we've got a really good deal, they're gonna be there on that deal, and it's a broader base of investors, so we can protect against a smaller B round in the future. So there's a couple things we're doing.
Okay, very good. Any others with thoughts on that topic?
Sure. This is Josh. Michael, you mentioned it before the call started. I think the same strategy that our group has used, and that we as much as possible try to avoid investments that as a part of their business plan are going to require additional investment prior to a cash flow positive standpoint. And, of course, that limits the pool of potential investments by a good bit, but then the other thing that our group has worked with is, that I think Bill mentioned, is we certainly try to build that in on the front end as much as possible, working actively with both our institutional folks as well as some of our higher net worth members that are interested in participating in additional rounds. But primarily, we've just carved out a large section of deals that we just don't think are appropriate in this environment.
Yeah, this is in the guest. A lot of the deals we're dealing with are in healthcare, so you usually need more than one round of capital. So in our ecosystem, what we have done is that in addition to angel investors, we have venture investor members as well as industry members. And we try to expose the company earlier than they normally would have been exposed to potential investors for the Series B and C after us. And that has really worked very effectively so that we have a good feel for what does the company milestones have to be before the next people will come in.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
This is Sue Preston, and I want to emphasize, I think it's really important what Ann just said, that doing some early syndication with the VCs, there are some that will do early rounds, and also the corporate partners. For us, in clean energy, we can never go one round. So we also look for grants. Both federal and state grants that lengthen the use of the first round of financing. We look for some sovereign wealth funds and foreign investment opportunities. But one of the other things that we do is we're really careful about the very first round of an early stage company, as we call it, a seed round rather than an A round. And there's a psychology to that, that if you call the first round A and the company is still pre-commercial and you're doing a B round, there's a mentality that VCs have that to do a B round, the company already has to be started into commercialization, has customers and so forth, So you get just, it's a perception issue that I think is healthy to avoid that. But the bottom line, I think, for all of us is that we tell our companies to network and create relationships, but I think it's just as important for us as investors to have very healthy networks out there, and I think that's been reflected in some of the comments so far.
And this is Terry Moore, and I think about this a little differently. From my standpoint, we all know venture capital, very little capital has been raised the last couple of years for new funds. However, in Silicon Valley, let's say 5 years ago, there were 160 venture capital funds, and I don't know exactly what the number is, but let's say there's 90 venture capital funds today with new funds and capital to invest, and that's what I focus on, those 90 funds that have raised capital recently that have to invest. And I'd like to just make the point that I often see deals where there's 30 or 60 days left cash in the bank, and that's not enough time. And so I would just advise companies to make sure that they have enough runway to raise cash and that they raise cash when they don't need it. I mean, that's nice to say, but raise that capital when you don't need it, and make sure you have enough runway to raise all the capital you need.
Yeah, good advice.
And what we do is we actually have five or six angel groups that are part of our network, same name, different countries, and we actually try to raise money from those angel groups when, if we notice or if we recognize that there will be a shortfall anywhere, and we also have people who invest with us, and so far we've been able to come up with the capital we needed. And one occasion we actually gave a bridge loan, but that's rare.
And that's a good topic to transition into next. Would any in the group discuss syndications, either internal syndications within your network or syndications just outright with other angel groups, and the success of that in order to keep your portfolio companies moving along?
Yeah, this is Anne here. I think we try to be the expert in our space so that we do the heavy lifting and, price the round, and we try to avoid doing bridges, and so that we can bring syndications. And we have most of our members are in multiple angel groups for that reason, and so we do heavy syndication with our angel groups nationwide.
I'm Terry Moore with the VC Roundtable, and I can't tell you how many deals, but dozens have been presented, and it's funny when you have the group around the table, how others will say, I didn't know you were looking at that. Let's get together and share diligence, and then 60 to 90 days later, a round or transaction will close. And so I think it's great to be able to syndicate. It's on the rise again. Investors aren't so greedy anymore, for the most part, and they realize they want to share the risk, and good partners make a lot of sense.
Okay, very good. Anything else on syndications?
I do have a comment about horror stories is that we've had cases, where angels, put the round, the company is moving around, the VC comes in there, they put their syndication, they keep the angels out of the boardroom, so, we become much more passive. And then, some of the VC syndicate falls apart, and it could be for multiple reasons. One, they decide they no longer do early stage or investment, they're going to do growth equity. We had one situation like that. And the next one is that they had some partnership issue internally, the partners leave, and they no longer support the portfolio of that partner. And then the other ones are situations there where they run out of money because their funds hasn't had liquidity in a long time, especially in the medical. It has been an issue there where people can't get exits. And so suddenly, the company is having a bad outcome for reasons that have nothing to do with the company business, and we angels have nothing we can do about it.
All right, transitioning next, let's talk a little bit about cramdowns. I have used cuss words in front of venture partners. Years later, I am still embarrassed that I've used. Why don't we talk about cramdowns and how to avoid cramdowns within our portfolio companies? Anyone would like to start that off?
Yeah, this is Terry. I'll chime in on this. I think it's really important to know your partners, and particularly those follow-on investors that you're going to be working with, so do as much diligence on them as they're doing on you and your company. And so you got to pick those partners wisely, and it helps to network and find out how they've worked with others in the past, what their modus operandi are, how do they operate. It's sometimes often difficult to protect yourself, but often, I've gone into board meetings, the first board meeting after an investment, And I'll take in the financial model, financial pro forma, and be hit with bad news by the company at the first board meeting that their sales are down, that the, all these things. And so you want to be up front with your investors as well. And so if there's operational issues, you know, please tell the good, the bad, and the ugly so that everybody's on the same page. And don't surprise investors at the first board meeting with problems that the company's facing that weren't surfaced prior to the close of the transaction.
I mean, this is, and another issue is the pay-to-play provision, which when company has raised significant capital there, it becomes an issue if it's forced on the original seed angels. And so we, like we just been said, you know, we try to develop a relationship with the venture people to say that in later round, angels should not have pay-to-play. There should be a minimum amount of investment to which the pay-to-play is getting triggered, which is usually at the venture investment level. And that's important because, you know, people don't reserve capital for, you know, the series C and D if a pay-to-play comes into it.
Yeah, and that's very good advice because as the dollars really start escalating in the you know, B and C rounds, it's just far outside of the realm of us angel investors. And if you've got a you know, pay-to-play, you know, provision of that nature that would accommodate much smaller infusions of capital by the angel side to stay in under the same terms, that sure helps, doesn't it?
Yeah, especially because you have zero control of what happened, you know, because by that time we're off the board and, you know, you have to fight to even have an observer right.
That's right. Very good. Any other comments on cram downs or experiences that you think that would might benefit the others?
Yeah, this is Josh again. I will say, and this topic's come up, I think, a number of times at some of our ACA meetings, that, you know, part of that is a valuation issue on the front end. You know, one of the benefits that we have to a certain extent of having our, when we are looking at a potential B and C round, having some of those parties in on the front end is we can get a little bit better feel of where we need to be from a valuation standpoint to avoid getting sideways with our B and C round investors later on to make sure that the numbers work for them as well as for us.
Very good. Let's now switch over to earnouts. That, you know, I think we all shiver when we hear that word because we know that almost guarantees a lawsuit. You know, I'm not sure what the mathematical probabilities of a lawsuit are whenever there are significant, you know, earnouts involved. But, you know, I bet it's in the, you know, 60 to 70%. You know, I don't think there's ever been a national survey to determine that, but it would be very, very high. You know, I've noticed a trend where a lot of the Silicon Valley cash-rich tech acquirers, you know, the Salesforces and the Oracles and IBMs, they tend to make, you know, more cash offers with, you know, where the only earnout piece is just tied to the technology transfer and the entrepreneur staying around for a little bit of time. Most of the other more traditional companies, or especially companies that are short on cash, their corporate development officers are trained to really push on the earnouts, and then bad things inevitably happen. Any experiences on earnouts and how to avoid losses on the earnouts?
Get cash all up front.
That's always the dream, right? We live for the dream. We live for the dream.
Got to have multiple acquirers so that you have options.
Yeah. Any other thoughts or strategies during that earnout you know, process or negotiating the earnouts? What to avoid?
Well, I think the key to look at are what are the metrics that you're going to be, you know, getting the earns on. Some are very clear-cut metrics, like in medical, you know, FDA approval is clear-cut. Some are very fuzzy, and that's when, you know, if you have a bad relationship with that buyer, you know, you may end up having problems.
Any other thoughts or advice on structuring earnouts to reduce losses and lawsuits? All right, let's switch over. Someone had one of the panelists had mentioned this topic. I'm not sure if it was Sue or Ann or Beth Ann, but it was when VCs take over and don't live up to their promises.
It was me.
Yeah, can you talk about that, and then maybe we'll pass that topic around to the others?
Okay. Well, we actually had experience with this when we thought it was great. A VC came in and asked us to please stay involved because he wanted some of our expertise. And then he went out and found another VC to help him along with this particular company. And the two of them got into a huge fight, and both of them decided they weren't going to do anything with the company. which of course results in the company losing everything. And in the end, I guess what we learned from that experience, we knew the first VC, and we had done business with him before, and we thought a lot of him, and we met the second VC and liked him. But the problem was the first VC obviously wasn't committed enough to the deal. And as soon as they began having problems between them, there was very little we could do. I mean, we were on the very short end of what could be accomplished, and we just watched it fall apart. Not a good story.
Any others with similar experiences or anything to elaborate on that topic?
Well, I mean, some of the experience I've had is that, you know, as company goes from the seed where you have a lot of mentoring and hands-on help, you know, from the angels, and then the VC takes over, they become more and more financially driven. And so the board at times doesn't really ask some of the hard questions. They focus more financials than, you know, market creation. And suddenly they have these high expectations and it doesn't happen. And then they turn around to say, this was a bad deal. Why did you show it to me? And so I think the problem is the structure of the board and the culture of the board start changing from being financial oversight instead of helping the entrepreneur build a business.
Okay, very good.
And this is Terry. Yeah, I think part of the problem is that there are enough VCs with extensive operating background, and I think that's where some of the questions on the board, with strategy, respective strategy, aren't there. And if they're financially motivated, that's one thing. But if they've actually dealt with issues the company's facing, have experience, and can roll up their sleeves and help those companies through those issues, I think that's what needs to happen. And so we need more VCs that have actually been entrepreneurs, built companies, sold them successfully, and have dealt with a lot of the operating issues the companies are facing to be more helpful. And I think too many MBAs, newly minted or relatively green MBAs, entered the venture capital industry without a lot of industry, and they were involved in strategy and at the board level and steered companies often in the wrong direction or provided little assistance with their operating issues. And so finding the right partner with that extensive operating background in your industry and deep domain expertise is really helpful.
Well, one of the things we have done that doesn't always work is that we say that some of our angels have this great, you know, added value operating background and market expertise, and we want them to be independent board members. And in order to reward them, we have to give them some common stock options. So some VCs are forward thinker and they see the value and they have no problem with that. Our VC, they just think, you know, they say, what, you know, they don't get any fees, so why should we give it to anybody else? So managing these expectations, understanding the weakness of the management team, and as the syndicate is being put together, really explaining why keeping these angels involved and paying them for their time is critical. It needs to be done all up front. Otherwise, you just set yourself up for problems later.
Okay, very good. Any other thoughts on that topic? All right, next one, selling too soon or waiting too long to sell or timing it just right. I think that this particular topic has vexed every one of us. You know, I think that, you know, many of us have, or most of us have experienced, you know, exits, and we always wonder, you know, what would have happened if we had sold a little sooner or a little bit later to maximize that value. There's the opportunity, cost and the loss associated, with that if the timing is off. And how do you time that? And I think that all of us are incredibly entertained when we attend those board meetings and we see those young entrepreneurs trying to plot out when the optimum time to exit is, because as we all know, the odds of the strategic acquirer, you know, wanting to buy the company intersecting with when that particular company thinks it's at its optimum time to sell, you know, the odds of that are so slim to coincide. It just so rarely happens. Any thoughts out there as to how do you get the timing right, and, you know, how do you make those things better align?
Well, this is a good question. I think that we will always do Monday morning quarterbacking on those issues, and it's really tough just to even find an appropriate buyer for companies a lot of times. But one of the things that we do is that we ask the question of where the exit is before we even invest. And we actually spend a huge amount of time looking at the potential acquirers, the market, and actually talking to those folks, because they're often early partners or strategic targets and so forth. So we actually spend a considerable amount of time before we make an investment looking at where the exit would be and working on that market sector of it and making sure that a company doesn't have just a one or two potential exit scenario opportunities, but this is a company that has multiplicity of areas in which they can fit into market sectors along their entire value chain. And there's two or three drop-off points that they could hit. So you do have a better chance of having a larger pool and a competition or competitive process. And that's always the best way to get what you feel is the good money for the company is to have one more than one acquirer.
Hey, I'd like to follow up, Bill Pott. I'd like to follow up on that point because I agree with that. I wrote an article about this one point. And that is the average hold time for an angel deal, Kauffman statistics, are about 14 years right now, 14 years. So even if there's successes with that kind of average to exit, you're not sure how much money you've made, especially with the dilution that occurs along the way. And by the way, the VC, and the reason that's so long, I would have guessed it was 7 or 8 years, the reason it's so long is because, don't forget, the angels traditionally come in, you know, 3+ years earlier than a VC. And the VCs, Cross Atlantic, I just said, their average exit right now is 10 years. And these are basically 10-year funds, so you need the 2-year-plus extension. Otherwise, you need longer than that now because that's the average. So that's all moving in that direction. Some of the other angel groups I've talked to basically don't look at this issue, and the issue becomes, well, we're just going to go as the business develops, and this, whatever time it takes is going to take. So we've found that the deals we're doing now, we're looking at the relationships the current management team and board have with the likely acquirer of the business. So what does that mean? That means we look at deals where the customer, in effect, is the likely acquirer. We want some type of validation. It could be that the management team has been there, done that before, sold businesses. That's the easy one. Or the board has relationships with that customer's likely acquirer, and they're going to push that. We're looking at a deal down in Florida right now where there are three well-known names as investors, private investors in the deal, so it's well-funded. It's in the ERP, CRM space. They put in $14 million. And we're trying to get that deal done with some other angel groups now because we feel that, A, it's backstopped. There is capital going into that deal from a billionaire who's put $4.5 million in. They've got $4.5 million last year, $6.5 million this year. And the bet is that the guy who's got $5 million in there, a wealthy investor, the billionaire, that he has the relationships to get that company sold. And I think that's going forward, that's the type of deal we would look at with an optimal time of going back what the VCs used to do, 3 to 4 years, and that's what we look for.
Okay. You know, to your point, it'd be really fascinating to see if the, you know, let's say the next time the Kauffman Foundation underwrites a study, you know, maybe in 2 or 3 years from now to determine the average, you know, hold time for angels, I'm willing to bet that that time will be dramatically reduced because so many of us, back in 2005, 2006, you know, I think the odds of, you know, going from angel to venture, you know, were around, you know, probably a 40% chance of that. Now, because there are so many fewer VCs, you know, I'm not exactly sure what that number is, but I bet it's, you know, one in seven, 1 in 10. And as a result of that, so many of us, if we even smell the possibility that company will need, you know, a venture round, we just won't touch it. And so it'd be really fascinating to see when they revisit that, you know, those stats and average hold times by angels in 2 or 3 years, you know, what that impact will be. But I bet it'll be a dramatic shortening of the average hold time. And I think someone else was going to say something.
Yeah, this is Terry. I've got a great story around that. I'm an angel investor in a company called Mobi TV, and I invested back in October of 2002. As one of the earliest investors in a low single-digit pre-money valuation. And, you know, it was a risk. I just believed in the two entrepreneurs, two PhDs from MIT, that they developed something really cool and took it to all the VC groups. And everyone thought I was crazy to want to invest in a company where they were going to broadcast live television over the cellular networks on cell phones. And so I just believed in these two entrepreneurs and invested. And we were later able to raise venture capital from some top-tier funds, Menlo and Redpoint and Oak. But it took a while before they warmed up to the deal. And so it's now approaching 9 years, and the company is approaching $100 million in sales and are planning for filing an S-1 maybe this year or early next year. But we had an offer from Rupert Murdoch and News Corp for over $250 million 4 years after my investment. The board passed. It would have been a nice exit for the angel investors and the founders. However, here we are approaching 9 years later and shooting for $1 billion plus exit. And so I think as angel investors, you just have to be prepared to hang in there with the companies and ride it out. And so I think you never know where these things are going to go, but hopefully they exit positively and in a relatively timely manner.
Yeah, that makes sense. Any other comments on that topic?
Well, one comment I have is that I've been lucky to have had 10 IPOs, and one of the challenges when you get an IPO is that, you know, is after you have the crash of the stock after the lockout expired, you know, is when do you sell out? And most of the angels were busy doing other things, and how do you stay on top of these companies? And if you're a group of angels, then everybody has to make a separate decision. So, you know, managing those type of public exit is not always straightforward.
Yeah, that is for sure. Anything else on that topic? All right. Next is losses at the time of a sale when you're shopping that company. You know, I've seen so many exits where the exiting company starts going steady with one buyer versus creating an auction environment. And you know, again, we're Monday morning quarterbacking the thing, but so many times we wonder just how much value was lost because of that. But then again, it's nice to have that almost understood, you know, feeling that that company is going to get bought. It sure brings, you know, that sure warms our heart when we know there's a pot of gold at the end of that rainbow, even if it's a smaller pot of gold. Any thoughts or comments on that? And how do you create a more robust environment at the time of exit? Anyone on that topic?
Yeah, I think the main thing is, you know, to build a company that's going to be there. And so often you hear entrepreneurs talk about flipping their companies. They're going to do something and they're going to sell. And it's really about creating lasting value. Then the investors will find that robust value that you've created. So it's preparing your company, putting in the right systems and processes, preparing to be a standing, built to last, long-term company, and creating that long-lasting value is very important to the robust exit. But you know, often I think, I love to have the exit figured out before we make an investment, and we do have a scenario around that exit. But that so often changes, and so following industry trends, seeing how the industry is peaking, and timing that where the industry seems to be, an environment for an outperformance for the exit is very important so you can have a premium evaluation. And so all of those things, getting the analyst support early and following the company and looking at their comparative advantages, in other words, what they do better than anybody else in the world, is very important and getting that message out broadly to investors so that they can get excited about acquiring the company.
Yeah, I think that this is a good question. There's a bit of luck here in having proper timing, unfortunately. And you can increase, but from a sort of a boring side of it and the legal aspect of it, building a company as if you're going to go public, even though you know your strategy is an acquisition, it does provide value, or what it does is it doesn't devalue the company. So you have a clean corporate structure. You are appealing from that standpoint to acquisition targets. The company has grown in a proper manner that way and is not messy. It does make a difference. It's done proper IP protection. So all those steps along the way, everything that you do adds a level of value, or it eliminates a risk, or eliminates a reason for a lower value, or eliminates a reason for a higher earnout as opposed to cash. So I think we just need to think about how we grow these companies at all levels and all aspects.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with that. This is Andy Gist. I mean, I think we've had several cases where you get the company through the process of right from the beginning, where are going to be your exits, get yourself organized in case of an idea, we could put a process and a structure in place. And then very often we had a company with DS1 all done, and that's when we had to buy up. And because by that time, you know, you have really forced the company and the buyers to go through a process of managing expectations, and everything is aligned.
And on that topic, of exiting and maximizing the price of the exit, I've seen time and time again the spoiling of a sale by asking too much or too little. It's so hard to determine what the value is to that strategic buyer. You know, I think we all desperately try to pin that down, but sometimes it's such a wide range. It's very, very hard to deal with. And as a result, sometimes a ridiculous price is asked in the buyer's mind, in the strategic buyer's mind, you know, or they ask so little that a huge amount of opportunity loss was left on the table. Any thoughts there? And I'm trying to figure out the value to the strategic buyer. How do you approach that? How do you try to eliminate the asking too little or asking too much that is not even a contender in their minds?
Sure. This is Josh with the Birmingham Angel Network. I think part of what we talk about pretty actively with our companies, at least at the board level, as we're growing, is what that exit looks like. And I think the expectation is set within the company that we're going to have some of our more experienced negotiators handle those negotiations. You know, I don't know that that's that's something that's best left to the founder just because they're the founder. So there is a lot of art to feeling that out, and so I don't know that you can absolutely just get it right, but you certainly can put people in place that have done it well before and trust that experience.
Any other thoughts on that topic? All right, let's move on. Instead of talking about the exit, let's talk for a few minutes on the picks of which companies we bring into our portfolios and which ones we invest into. One of the challenges that we all face as angel investors is determining what trends are going to take off out there, and more importantly, which of those trends will be profitable versus what I would call hot trends with no substance. A number of those come to mind. I remember an investment I made in the e-learning space. Huge amounts of money went in there over the last decade and a half. Literally billions of dollars into it. A whole lot less than billions in profitability within that space. Another one, just thinking back just two or three years, RFID. RFID was everywhere, and these companies are all going to be worth huge amounts of money, when in fact there was just a couple of winners and everyone else kind of fell to the wayside. How do you validate in our environment, hot trends that will have substance versus hot trends that will not have substance? Any words to the wise?
In our case, this is Bethann. In our case, what we try to do is we have a variety of, we have a, I'm sure every angel group does, has a group of people who are experts in certain areas, and we try to rely to a great extent on some of their knowledge. And in many cases, they have been able to direct us away from investments, which sounded very good as soon as they heard some of the details and some of the things we were looking at. So we rely on internal experts, as well as occasionally going outside and relying on external experts just to have discussions with and see what they feel. I mean, obviously, if we had a crystal ball, we'd all be rich. But that's what we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree, and this is Andy Gaze from Health Tech Capital. In our case, we need three sets of expertise. We need to understand the healthcare workflow, the regulatory. We need to understand the technology enabling platforms, and we need to understand how to engage the patients and the consumer type of technology. What we find out is that very often the entrepreneurs or the VCs are missing some of these equations. So that's why in our membership we're trying to attract people from these three areas of expertise, and we have passed on deals that some of the tech VC are doing a spring and pray right now in our space, and we just thought this just didn't make any justification. We passed on it. And so I think you need to be able to say no and have an intelligent discussion and feel comfortable with the expertise in the group.
Okay, any other...
This is,
Bill
Pike from Landmark. It's interesting, if you look at statistically, as an example, probably from the angel side, one of the sectors that has traditionally always been there has been life science, and also devices. So if you look at category-wise, they're probably the two most prominent areas of investment for angel groups nationwide. And if you look at that, we drill down, like at our own group, we have a few MD, PhDs, so we got a couple. We have some MDs. But basically the question is, what's the expertise of the group as a whole in any of these angel groups that are out there in these particular areas? And you obviously, the rule is you should invest in areas that you don't know, which is what everybody's been saying. Yet, statistically, these groups do not have the relevant people who can make these decisions. So the question is, do you go outside and a deal you're looking to do and get that outside expertise to help you make that decision if you don't have it internally? Or some groups, do you just go ahead because it looks interesting and make the investment anyway, which obviously then you're going to increase your failure rate. So
it's a very good point. So what we have done is that we have provided free membership to providers. So we've developed a relationship with the Cleveland Clinic, UCSF, and Stanford, so that when we have an area which really is very specific in physiology, workflow, and all of that, we can go there and validate, one, is there a problem? Number two, is there a need? And number three, would they pay if somebody had a solution that worked? And I think when you start going into medical, which is very complex, you have to at times get out of the network and validate it.
Hmm. Any other thoughts on that topic? Let's change stick within the planning area, and let's talk a little bit about poor pricing strategy. I think a ton of us have taken losses because that company just didn't have the pricing right or optimized. How can we as investors and angels help them? And any war stories or anything that would add value to the audience on pricing strategies?
I think the one comment I would have, if you sell capital equipment, people always underestimate the support and maintenance and training installation. They always look at the cost of goods sold of the equipment and then they just, do a 2 or 3x and that becomes their price. So not only they don't capture the value that they create with the customer, but they totally underestimate, and that's a bit the arrogance of the technical founders, is that the product will work and will never fail. And it's so obvious they know how to use it, you need to train them or give them some clinical expertise. So I think people totally underestimate that part usually.
Yeah. Any other thoughts on pricing strategies and how we can help guide the founders and the CEOs on that topic? All right, moving on to some other topics. Let's talk about fraud or personal use of business funds. We haven't experienced that yet within our portfolio companies, but we keep them on a pretty short leash. Any war stories out there?
Sure. Yeah, we unfortunately, this is Josh from the Birmingham Angel Network. We had an IPO that got scuttled thanks to some fraud that occurred, and so it certainly can happen. I have said many times I almost can't have too many accountants in the company. I like having lots of folks keeping eyes on things, but at its core, we were in an industry and had some folks in that industry that we were aware that it was a rough industry and had occasionally questionable characters in it. And, I don't know that you get into a lot of those things, at least certainly not very often, where if you know the individuals well enough and the parties involved, that, that something like that's going to occur totally out of the blue. And for the honest folks that just get in a tight, that's what good accounting procedures and audit procedures are for. Absolutely, if you have cash lying around, if you do enough deals, eventually somebody's going to act inappropriately.
Any other war stories out there?
Well, I have one case, and I mean, it's public knowledge, but, the company filed for the IPO and everything was ready to go, and then the day before the going public, they got sued for somebody told me 5 years earlier there, I talked to the founders and claimed that they should have some rights on the technology. It was pure greenmail. Hmm. But the timing was so horrible that there's nothing we could have done except to stop the IPO. $500K lost, you know, and basically having to go with another banker. And at the end, it was pure greenmail. There was no reason. We gave them some stock options for them to go away. But, you know, you can never stop those. So, you know, you have to be really careful, you know, with the founders to make sure there's no real skeleton that comes out. And they usually wait just around the IPO time for that to come out.
Yeah, I've got one where I put some money into a company in Kansas City whose name shall remain nameless, but that doesn't mean I still wouldn't like to strangle them. And just the perfect rise in profitability, you know, quarter by quarter by quarter, just the most perfect rise, and someone kicked me, you know, that doesn't exist, right? And I should have known that. And, oh, you know, Ernst & Young financials, everything looked good, and, oh, well, in any case, it is what it is. All right, that was a painful topic. Let's move on quickly. Next one, miscalculating the amount required. I think that we all wrestle with this. If we, you know, underestimate, we've got a big problem, right? And we're sitting there trying to help the founders scramble for more capital. If we overestimate, it dings the IRR of that investment. Any thoughts or best practices or ideas on how you get it right? How you try to determine the correct amount of capital that business needs? Any insights there? Or how to avoid miscalculating?
Well, this is the guest. I think it's asking all the questions about what are the assumptions you're making for what's usually an optimistic forecast. You know, really pushing down, and we always force a worst-case scenario. What happens if it takes you twice the amount of time, and if you need more data, if you're having some setbacks, you know, what does that do? And we ask for two scenarios, the best case and the worst case, and then we take the worst case and assume that's going to be the optimistic one.
Okay, very, very good. All right, let's go ahead, and we've got a few more topics we'd like to cover, but also if anyone in the audience would like to ask the panel a question, if you would, just go ahead and hit *6 and just cut on in and ask your question and just kind of override us and get that question out there. Just after you ask your question, please hit *6 again to keep the background noise under control. So again, if you have any questions, just go ahead and ask them live. Just go ahead and hit *6 and ask your questions. And while we're waiting on that, let's talk a little bit about one of the largest expenses, typically, especially on the A round, is allotments for marketing, you know, and or sales. And, you know, I think that we've all seen huge amounts of money wasted on that A round, on that marketing and sales. For whatever reason, it seems like the hit ratio is about 1 in 3 CEOs that can really leverage that money correctly and ends up rolling out a very, very cost-efficient marketing and sales process. There seems to be a huge amount of money wasted there. Any thoughts on that aspect or that juncture of the company?
Sure. Again, this is Josh, and this is one of my pet peeves. I've written more than one article on my frustration with entrepreneurs that want to focus on product development and punt on sales, and they figure they can throw enough money at it that the sales will figure itself out. So we drill down on that pretty hard. The adoption plan and what that really looks like, and what relationships are going to be required to be built and how that's really going to shape out is something that that we look at very, very hard. Because we all know that sales don't come, you know, like the entrepreneurs typically think they're going to. You know, it almost never happens. And so, that's certainly an area that we beat up very, very hard.
We've experienced situations where we have what I would call well-marketed salespeople, and the entrepreneur or founders team really trusts that those well-marketed salespeople or sales managers with a lot of capital, and the sales just don't end up materializing. I'm not sure if anyone else has experienced that as well. Let's talk a little bit about over-dependence on a single customer. A lot of times, especially in the early stages, many of us see that. Any thoughts or advice on how you coach the leader to diversify their customer base? You know, I think it's a fairly logical thing, right? And they know they should do it, but meanwhile they've got that single client feeding them more and more orders. Any thoughts or advice on that particular topic? All right, very good. Let's move on to some other questions. Talk about issuing founding shares without vesting. So often we've seen losses where it's the intention of the co-founders to all work equally hard. Inevitably, one of the co-founders or just doesn't work nearly as hard or backs off or needs to take a real job to make ends meet. And then, comes back in a year later once the company is successful and claims, equal rights because, boy, they were issued the same number of shares as the ones who stayed in and worked very, very hard. Any thoughts there on issuing founder shares, without vesting? And what kind of advice do you provide the founding members of the teams that you invest in?
This is Andy Gaze. We just had a situation where we walked away from a term sheet we had written because when we did the due diligence, it was kind of sneaky that they wrote themselves some employment contract the week before where they basically you could not terminate them for any reasons and automatically their stock would vest. So it's, what people are doing, instead of doing the traditional, like you're describing, issuing the founder share without vesting, they're having a vesting, but if you look deep down into the details, this vesting never kicks in because if you terminate them for good cause or for good reasons, they can basically automatically accelerate everything. So I think we need to be much more careful when people tell us they're vesting to earlier in the process check what their contract obligations are.
Okay, very good. Looking at the time, it looks like we're almost out of time, and so let's see if we can kind of quickly wrap up here. First, thank you to all the panelists for taking an hour to share your thoughts with so many angels across North America today. Your involvement and dedication to entrepreneurism sets a high benchmark for others to follow. Thank you very, very much. For all the angel groups that were able to join us across North America, we appreciate your participating. Hopefully this Angel Knowledge Series will be useful in your efforts. Some quick comments about upcoming events. Everyone on the call today may listen to past events and participate in future events at no charge. You may see a full listing of future events at angelpool.org. Again, that is angelpool as in swimming pool, angelpool.org, and then clicking on the Knowledge tab. There are a number of high-profile speakers and panels coming up that will be discussing various aspects of angel investing best practices, including Reid Hoffman of LinkedIn in a few months. The next few events are on June 9th. Jeff Clavier of SoftTech will be discussing capital-efficient, lean startup best practices. And on June 23rd, there will be another panel, and the topic will be deal flow and quality best practices. This call was recorded and should be available probably by tomorrow, maybe even by the end of today, again, at angelpool.org. And again, to the panel, a very, very special thank you for taking the hour. It's right at the top of the hour. This call is now concluded. Thank you all, and have a great day.